Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Jamal Abdi with the National Iranian American Council, who warns that President Trump's decertification of the International Nuclear Agreement with Iran will isolate and undermine U.S. credibility around the world. Egan Kemp of Public Citizen, who examines the impact of President Trump's recent executive orders on the cost and coverage of health care insurance for millions of Americans. And Lori Sobel, the Kaiser Family Foundation, who discusses how the Trump administration issued new rules that give employers the right to deny their female employees access to birth control insurance coverage. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The government of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is waging an active campaign to discredit a new global estimate of modern slavery developed by the International Labour Organization, the International Organization for Migration, and the Australia-based Walk Free Foundation. The recently published reports estimate that 40 million people across the globe are victims of forced labor, forced marriage, and human trafficking. The research found that over 60% of the victims of slavery live in the Asia-Pacific region. India's Intelligence Bureau drafted a secret memo to the Prime Minister stating that these reports target India as home to the highest number of slaves in the world. The memo warns that the estimate could substantially harm India's image, exports, and damage the nation's ability to meet the United Nations Sustainable Development Goal of eradicating forced and child labor and human trafficking. Of particular concern was a potential backlash against South Asia's textile industry, which is affected by laws in the United States and United Kingdom requiring garment suppliers to demonstrate they do not employ forced labor. A series of reports by European activist groups raised concern about widespread slavery, including the use of child labor in producing India's textiles for export to Western corporations. Under intense pressure to end Chicago's epidemic of violence, politicians and federal law enforcement agencies waged a campaign in 2014 against street-level gun dealers. The drive used paid informants who set up gun deals that entrapped numerous inner-city residents for selling guns. According to ProPublica, most of the guns seized in Chicago come from Indiana and other nearby states, which have weaker gun laws. Most of the guns police seize were initially legally purchased, after which they were sold, loaned, or stolen, ending up in Chicago's firearms black market. Most illegal gun sales in the Windy City are brokered by individuals or small groups, not organized by large trafficking syndicates. Under pressure to respond to the violence, law enforcement has focused on making examples of people caught selling, buying, or possessing guns. But authorities acknowledge that these cases do little to stem the flow of guns into the city. An in-depth examination of one case showed how authorities targeted mostly street-level offenders, sometimes enticing them with outsized payoffs. Leading critics say their techniques raise questions of whether they are dismantling gun networks or effectively helping to set them up. Amid the fury of recent hurricanes Harvey, Irma, and Maria, Louisiana has made substantial investments in coastal land protection. This includes developing a new coastal floodgate system of levees and locks to protect Terrebonne Parish from storm surges. It's one of the costliest infrastructure projects made without the aid of U.S. government funding. Currently, Louisiana loses a football field's worth of land every hour due to a combination of factors including rising sea levels, sinking land, levee building, and drilling for oil and gas that have disrupted the Mississippi River Delta's natural marshland building processes. The loss of land leaves coastal communities exposed to damaging storm surges, which are expected to increase with climate change. Hurricane Harvey, which deluged Greater Houston, cost over $190 billion in damages, equal to the combined cost of the destruction caused by Hurricane Katrina and Superstorm Sandy. Some observers say Louisiana shouldn't have to tackle such an immense challenge on its own, particularly given the likelihood that other states will soon be facing similar hurdles. According to critics, the limited role the federal government has played thus far in Louisiana is inexcusable. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.
President Donald Trump announced on October 13th that he's formally decertifying the international nuclear agreement with Iran. While Mr. Trump has stated that, quote, the Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States ever entered into, unquote, he declined to terminate the Iran agreement. Instead, he moved the issue to Congress, where legislators will engage in a 60-day period of debate on whether or not to reimpose economic sanctions against Iran that had been in effect before the nuclear deal was signed in 2015. Reimposition of the sanctions will effectively withdraw the U.S. from the nuclear agreement. While Trump has repeatedly stated that Iran has violated the spirit of the agreement, the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency says that Iran is in compliance. The other signatories to the deal, Russia, China, France, Britain, and Germany, all have maintained their support for the deal, just as Trump's own Defense Secretary, Secretary of State, and the Pentagon's Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff have publicly expressed support for the agreement. Your reporter spoke with Jamal Abdi, Policy Director with the National Iranian American Council, who assesses the fallout from Trump's decision to decertify the Iran nuclear deal and warns that a move to withdraw the U.S. from the agreement will both isolate and undermine U.S. credibility around the world.
By decertifying, it doesn't do anything on its own. But what it does is it kicks off a 60-day period in Congress where there are expedited rules to introduce sanctions legislation to snap back the sanctions that were eased under the nuclear deal. Now, that 60-day window is now open, and what it means is that if the majority or minority leaders in either the House or the Senate, if they introduce legislation that specifically snaps back the nuclear sanctions, no other sanctions, only the sanctions that were lifted under the deal, that legislation is guaranteed to get a vote. It can't be stopped in committee. It goes to the floor in the chamber it's introduced in. It gets a vote. It gets passed to the other chamber. And the key is that in the Senate, there is no filibuster. It is a straight majority, you know, simple majority vote. So unlike when the deal actually got through Congress and you had, you know, every single Republican voting against it, but they had to hit that 60-vote threshold, now we've got this simple majority. And so this is sort of a conundrum that this Congress has had under Trump, this Republican Congress, this responsibility of governing. And so really nobody in Congress, even those people who oppose the deal, they don't actually want to kill the thing. They just want to rack up these political points and say how much they hate it. But what Donald Trump has effectively done, unwittingly, is kind of called their bluff. And now it's up to either, you know, Kevin McCarthy in the House or Mitch McConnell in the Senate. If they introduce that snapback legislation, it's going to get a vote. Either enough Republicans are going to have to vote to protect the deal, or they vote against it, the sanctions snap back, and the U.S. is then in violation of the deal. That means the U.S. basically exits the deal. And then we find out, okay, can the deal be salvaged by just, you know, Europe, China, Russia, and Iran? Or does Iran end up wanting to back out of elements of the deal? And it's sort of a nightmare. Nobody really knows how that process plays out.
What's the likely response in Iran to this ongoing process in the United States that jeopardizes this nuclear agreement, especially from the hardline factions within the Tehran government?
For the hardliners, this is an I told you so moment. The supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, who has, you know, final say over these things. What the supreme leader said was, okay, you can go ahead with these negotiations. That's fine. But at the end of the day, you can't trust the United States. Even if we deal with the nuclear issue, they're just going to pivot and say there's some other reason that they're our enemy. And so this is a futile exercise, but you go ahead with it. I'm not going to stop you. And now they're really saying, I told you so. But I think inside of Iran, the challenge here is it sort of empowers the hardliners, and it sort of forces, you know, Rouhani and the moderates. They've actually had to sort of – Rouhani actually challenged the IRGC and the hardline, you know, military wing in Iran, challenged them in his election, which is unprecedented. And now, after what Trump did, he's actually having to stand up for the IRGC. And so you sort of see this homogenization homogenization of the politics in Iran because of Trump's move.
One last quick question. If either Congress or Donald Trump abrogate this international nuclear agreement with Iran, what are the consequences for U.S. credibility in the world? And I'm thinking about, you know, any hope there might be for some kind of nuclear control agreement with North Korea. It's hard to understand how a country would approach the United States with Donald Trump in the White House to sign on to such an agreement.
Yeah, and I think that we're sort of talking about pulling out the thread of all of our, diplomatic tools here. I mean, I think some of the damage has already been done. Now there's sort of a question of, well, we deal with one president, and then the next president, who knows who's going to be elected, and they apparently don't feel that they are beholden to the agreements that the country signed previously. So I think that, especially when we look at North Korea, where, you know, this is going to be a huge diplomatic undertaking if we're going to be able to solve that challenge, peacefully. And all this has done is just sapped our credibility and sapped our leverage to be able to ask for anything now that we're not a trustworthy actor. So I think it's extremely damaging to diplomacy, and it sort of puts the U.S. in the position of the only, tool that you can actually, view as credible is military force. And that's a really dark prospect, I think, going forward, not just for this presidency, but for administrations to come potentially.
That was Jamal Abdi, policy director with the National Iranian American Council. Find links to more news and commentary about the Iran nuclear agreement by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After several major attempts to repeal the Affordable Care Act, commonly known as Obamacare, President Trump issued two executive orders on October 12th with the stated goal of dismantling his predecessor's landmark healthcare legislative achievement. The first executive order asked the Labor Department to loosen rules that permit small companies to form associations and buy the kind of coverage available to larger businesses. These plans would have lower standards and cover far fewer healthcare costs. The second executive order ends $9 billion in subsidies paid under the Obamacare program to reduce the cost of health insurance for low-income Americans. Ironically, nearly 70% of those benefiting from subsidies cut by the president live in states Trump won in the 2016 presidential election. Taken together, Trump's two executive orders will result in an increase in the number of Americans without health insurance, the erosion of health insurance standards, substantial increases in insurance premiums, market instability, and increased expenses for the federal government. The day after the executive orders were issued, 18 U.S. states sued the president to stop him from ending the payment of Obamacare subsidies. Meanwhile, Republican Senator Lamar Alexander of Tennessee and Democratic Senator Patty Murray of Washington State agreed in principle on a bill that would cover the subsidy payments for 2 years, but the fate of that legislation is uncertain at best. Your reporter spoke with Egan Kemp, healthcare policy advocate with Public Citizen and a former senior policy analyst at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. Here he examines the impact of President Trump's recent executive orders on the U.S. healthcare system.
Millions of Americans will experience either higher premiums, or they may, be scared away from getting coverages because there's going to be some sticker shock, even if their premiums might cover the cost, some of the cost changes.
Do we have an estimate of how many people could lose their health insurance over the course of the next year once these, specifically the subsidies, disappear?
We don't have an exact estimate, but there are some. There's the potential of millions of folks losing their coverage. The other thing that Trump had said that he was hoping that this would do was to save money, but that we also know that's not the case based on estimates from the Congressional Budget Office, that ultimately, even though they're cutting these subsidies, it'll cost the federal government nearly $200 billion over the next decade because the insurance companies are now going to need to charge higher premiums But because of the way the law is structured, most folks, those increases will be covered by the federal government. So it's there will be, you know, around 1.5 to 2 million folks that are going to see, you know, direct increases that won't be covered by the subsidies that they're getting.
Now, how about the association health plans? What kind of impact does the Trump executive order on the association health plans have on the overall insurance market?
Yeah, that one's pretty significant as well, and you know, the implications there could be far-ranging. So this particular executive order, it directs certain parts of the federal government to make new rules or regulations. And what's scaring people is that the way that it could be written, it could allow companies to sell across state lines. And so, you know, something that we experienced before the Affordable Care Act was a race to the bottom in terms of insurance standards. So there was companies offering junk plans that could be sold across state lines, and that's sort of the fear that it could go back to that. So things that weren't that often weren't covered previously were maternity care or mental health services or severe limitations on prescription drugs. And the real fear is that folks could be end up thinking that they're paying less, but what they're paying for is a junk plan that won't cover them when they get sick.
What are the wider societal ripple effects from having these plans that don't really cover what they cover currently because of the ACA standards?
One of the benefits of the Affordable Care Act is a reduction in the amount of debt Americans are taking on due to medical expenses. Folks are able to get coverage earlier. They're able to maintain coverage. Without the proper regulation, someone could think they're signing up for something good, and then once they get sick, realize they have to bear all that expense, which may mean taking on medical debt and may mean declaring bankruptcy.
As I've been reading about these changes, one of the warnings that has been written about by a lot of commentators and those inside the health insurance industry is a general concern about what they call destabilization of the health insurance marketplace, which means you might have more health insurance companies pulling out of the Obamacare exchanges. But the effects could go further than that, I've been reading. Tell us what your concerns are about the stability of the marketplace.
Some states, they had their insurance companies provide two sets of rate increases. And so some states, maybe it was they had a tent, some insurers said, you know, we expect to raise it, you know, 8 to 10%. And then if the state asked them for the second set, it might have been, you know, 20 to 30%. And that's a big difference. And all of a sudden, if you're an insurer, you're about to start opening your market and start, you know, recruiting folks. So now you're having to, you know, have these much higher premiums. So anyone looking on, you know, any sort of state exchange or federal exchange, they're seeing some really high prices, and they might, you know, step away. And if there's less folks enrolling, that means the folks that are left who may be sicker are going to be facing even higher premiums over time. And that's one of the real concerns about sort of the destabilization is that you'd have insurance companies with these junk plans cherry picking the healthy people out of the market, which are just going to leave sick folks in the actual ACA regulated plans, meaning they're going to be paying outrageous sums. And, you know, it just may not be solvent that an insurance company just can't only be insuring the sickest folks.
Egan, what do we know about public opinion on Obamacare, whether to repeal, replace this kind of direct sabotage that we see from the White House? Do we know how Americans, by and large, feel Congress and the White House should be moving in terms of improving the health care system of the country?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we're seeing is that throughout the repeal and replace efforts, the Affordable Care Act has only gotten more popular. We're seeing, you know, the majority of Americans approving of what the Affordable Care Act does and wanting it continued, that it's a very small amount of Americans that want it, you know, repealed or repealed and replaced. Americans are realizing sort of the importance that the Affordable Care Act has meant for them. And I think that's only going to continue, especially if Americans continue to see higher premiums. And polling also indicates that, you know, Trump doesn't think he's going to get blamed for this. He said that again and again, but the polls don't say that. The polls indicate that that Congress and Trump will be held accountable for this sabotage.
That was Egan Kemp, healthcare policy advocate with Public Citizen and a former senior policy analyst at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. For more analysis of the Trump administration's policies impacting healthcare costs and insurance coverage, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In early October, the Trump administration announced a major rollback in coverage under the Affordable Care Act, which the Republican-dominated Congress has so far failed to repeal. Under the ACA, a suite of more than a dozen birth control options were required to be made available, at no cost, for women to choose the method best for them. That element of Obamacare was immediately challenged in court, based on the argument that employers should not be forced to provide birth control if they objected based on their religious beliefs. A convoluted system was later devised to respond to those concerns, which allowed women to receive the birth control insurance coverage they needed. According to the latest regulation issued by the Trump Department of Health and Human Services and the Department of Labor, the head of virtually any company can now decide that providing birth control coverage violates their religious beliefs or moral view, and deny their female employees free birth control coverage. The regulation went into effect on October 6th. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Lori Sobel, Associate Director of Women's Health Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Here she discusses how exemptions to the birth control mandate have grown over time, how the new rules change may affect women, and how groups across the U.S. are fighting back.
So under the Obama administration, there were rules that were drafted to allow for religious employers to have an exemption, and that was limited to houses of worship for the exemption, which had the effect of the women insured by those policies would not get contraceptive coverage. And then there was a second category allowing for an accommodation, which allowed religiously affiliated nonprofits, and then after the case of Hobby Lobby, closely held for-profits to have an accommodation, which meant that the employer had to notify someone. They had to notify either their insurer or third-party administrator or the government that they had a religious objection to providing some or all contraceptive coverage, and then the insurer was obligated to provide that coverage. So the effect on the people insured by those policies was that they still had full coverage for contraceptives with no cost sharing. It shifted who paid for that coverage, but the women and employed and the dependents that were insured by those plans still had full coverage.
But the Trump administration really blew a much bigger hole in the exemptions, right?
Right. So now the exemption is expanded to everyone who previously had the accommodation. They can choose to stay with the accommodation or shift to an exemption, which again has this impact that the workers and dependents would not have the coverage anymore. So there was a group of nonprofits in particular that had been litigating the accommodation, saying it didn't go far enough to meet their needs in terms of their religious beliefs, that they felt they were complicit in providing that coverage if they had to notify someone to that would then provide that coverage. So those nonprofits that have litigated will likely opt for an exemption now. In addition, the closely held for-profits can also opt for an exemption. That group of employers has not litigated the accommodation, but we don't know to what extent they had been complying with the accommodation. There's a whole new group of employers that would now be eligible for the exemption outside of those groups. So in addition, any employer, regardless if they're nonprofit or for-profit, including publicly traded companies that have a religious objection to providing some or all contraceptive coverage, can choose to be exempt. In addition, there's a new category of employers that have a moral objection, and that's open to any employer except for publicly traded for-profits. So all nonprofits and all for-profits that are not publicly traded can opt for an exemption based upon a moral objection to some or all contraceptive coverage.
So do the employers have to provide any kind of proof of their moral or religious opposition?
There's no proof that's required.
Lori Sobel, is there any way to figure out how many women could be impacted by these changes?
We certainly have no idea how many employers would take up a moral objection. There were numbers in the regulations that were really speculative. And it, by regulations, I mean the preamble before the regulations that the agencies wrote, that basically tried to figure out how many employers had litigated, and based upon that, how many would take the exemption versus the accommodation, and then try and figure out how many employees each of those organizations has. And the truth is we really have no idea, because this expands the categories so greatly that we don't know which employers would take this up.
So these changes have already gone into effect, but what's happening in the fight back?
There's active litigation going on already. The groups that I know about, that I'm not entirely clear if they've all filed, but they've all announced that they're going to litigate, is the National Women's Law Center, the ACLU, the Center for Reproductive Rights, the Attorney General of California, and the Attorney General of Massachusetts.
There's a silver lining for women who live in states that guarantee more coverage than the federal government, right?
There's 8 states that have their own laws that are at least as expansive as the ACA in terms of what's required, so no cost sharing for coverage of contraceptives of all 18 methods. Essentially, it's the ACA benefit required at a state level, and most of those states have a more narrowly defined exemption than is now in the federal law. So we know 61% of workers across the country that are covered workers are insured by self-insured plans, and those aren't regulated by the state. So that's where the gap will be. So if you're an employer in California that has a moral objection and you have a self-insured plan, then you're exempt from the federal law and you're not covered by the state law.
That was Lori Sobel, Associate Director of Women's Health Policy at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Learn more about the Trump and Republican Party's rollback of women's access to birth control by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, KTWH in Two Harbors, Minnesota, KMUD in Garberville, California, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.